Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Chisako Res, the chair of the club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listening and viewing audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now, it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. David Shank is a writer on genetics, talent, and intelligence. He is the national best-selling author of five previous books, including The Forgetting, Data Smog, and The Immortal Game. He is a correspondent for TheAtlantic.com and has contributed to National Geographic, Slate, The New York Times, Gourmet, Harper's, The New Yorker, NPR, and PBS. David's presentation today is based on his most recent book, The Genius in All of Us, which integrates cutting-edge research from a wide range of disciplines, including cognitive science, genetics, biology, and child development. Salon's review says, "The Genius in All of Us has quietly blown my mind." David will present a compelling case against the notion of genetic giftedness and suggest a completely new paradigm, not talent scarcity, but latent talent abundance. Please join me in welcoming David Shank.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Chisako. And thank you for coming. The Commonwealth Club. Wow, I used to listen to these programs when I, on my stints out in California and elsewhere. So this is, I was out there looking at the pictures, Lech Walesa and Condoleezza Rice and me. As Chisako said, my goal today is, it's a big subject, and my goal today is actually quite ambitious. I want to try to shift a little bit the way you think about how you became you and how your children become who they are as well. And we're going to try to quietly blow everyone's mind here. Loudly would be too much, too many minds. So in 1994, the psychologist Richard Herrnstein and policy analyst Charles Murray warned in their book, The Bell Curve, that we live in an increasingly stratified world where the genetic elite, those with the best genes, are more and more isolated from the cognitive/genetic underclass. Genetic partitioning, they called it. That's their phrase. There was no mistaking their message, and I'm going to show it to you. The irony is that as America equalizes the environmental circumstances of people's lives, the remaining differences in intelligence are increasingly determined by differences in genes. Putting it all together, success and failure in the American economy and all that goes with it are increasingly a matter of the genes that people inherit. Now, Herrnstein and Murray are, of course, neither the first nor the last to suggest this gene giftedness paradigm. You've heard politicians, scientists, and plenty of others whisper or even say out loud that certain racial groups are less intelligent than others, or that certain groups have better gene-driven athletic ability. And you've also heard, and probably even said yourself in one way or another, this notion in a more individual term, that some people are simply bestowed with certain innate gifts, musical, intellectual, athletic, while others are not. That talent and high intelligence are somewhat scarce gems scattered throughout the human gene pool, and that the best we can do is locate and polish these gems and accept the limitations built into the rest of us. So let's ask that question and try to answer it. Is, Is this true? Is there actually such thing as a genetic underclass or a genetic overclass? Or to put it more mildly, do some of us have better genes than others? For 100 years, we've accepted this some version of this gene giftedness paradigm. And I'm here to argue that this paradigm is fundamentally incorrect. It's my contention that even though it often appears to us that good and bad genes are what separate certain groups from one another, or at least certain individuals from one another, when you look closely at several different contemporary threads of science, it emerges that there is no genetic underclass or overclass among race, and that most of us are not genetically doomed to mediocrity. In fact, I think the science suggests, quite to the contrary, that the human genome that we all share is itself designed to respond to challenges and demands, and that, as Cornell University developmental psychologist Stephen Sesse says, we have no way of knowing how much unactualized genetic potential exists. Now, since this is partly a matter of language, what Michael Krasny this morning called semantics, but I'm sure he didn't mean to minimize it because semantics is quite important. Semantics and the words we choose are, after all, help build the ideas that we use to follow our lives. But since this is really largely about language and how we talk about science, let me quickly throw in some caveats about what I'm not saying. You just heard me say that our genome doesn't doom us to mediocrity, and that there's really no telling how much potential is within each person. But I've been doing this for 3 years now. I've been researching and writing this book and talking about it, at least with friends, for a number of years, and now I've been out on the road for a few weeks and done quite a bit of talking and listening to what people are saying. And if any of that experience is any guide, I'll bet many of you in the audience thought you heard me say that genetic differences don't exist, or that genetic differences don't matter, or that any of us can literally do or become anything. And I am actually not saying any of that. I'm trying to forge a new way of understanding this stuff that certainly does not embrace those extremes. So let me say categorically, so that you hear me. And hearing me wrong, I don't mean to suggest that you're not smart enough to follow this. What I'm trying to suggest is that we, as a culture, have been trained to think very much in terms of black and white, at least around these issues. So let me say categorically, genetic differences do exist. Genetic differences do matter tremendously. And all of us have limits, of course. If you're looking for someone to tell you that genes don't matter, that we're all born with exactly the same potential, that any of us can become anything, literally, then I'm not your guy, and this book certainly is not for you. What I am trying to suggest is that most of us really don't know what our true limits are. The science of genetics, talent, and intelligence all suggest that it's time to start thinking and talking about human abilities in an entirely new way. It's possible to appreciate the immense influence of genes, but also understand that as individuals, we are not put in a straitjacket by those genes, that in fact, we can impact our own genes. And another caveat, you'll hear a lot of caveats tonight, I really can't make this my whole case in one session. This is going to sound like a cop-out, but 3 years and 300 pages of a book, what I do in the book is actually bring together several different threads of science, arenas of science, and bring the themes out in each one and how they correspond with one another. And so I have to kind of pick and choose, and I'm going to try and actually emphasize genetics today and try to make that case. Of course, we'll talk about how people get good at stuff, but I don't expect you to be fully convinced by the end of this hour, and I hope that you will bear with me and perhaps if you're still open to what I'm suggesting, consider reading the book, if not buying it, borrowing it from the library. If you do buy it, ironically, you will help me pay for piano and judo lessons for these two wonderful Brooklyn kids. So if you do buy if you're considering buying the book, don't do it for me. Do it. Do it for them. These poor kids. They deserve a future. So let's start with genetics. There's a lot to say about genes, a lot that I'm sorry to say that you probably haven't heard. First, let's get one big point out of the way, and I'm not going to dwell on this, but it's an important point since the bell curve folks brought it up and made such a big deal of it. Races are not discrete genetic pools. skin color is a great deceiver on this point. Actual distinct genetic differences between ethnic groups and geographic groups are actually very, very limited. There's much more diversity inside any group that you can pull together. So, and I have one quote that illustrates this. While ancestry is a useful way to classify species because species are isolated gene pools most of the time, explains John Wilkins from the University of Queensland, it is rarely a good way to classify populations within species, and definitely not in humans. We move around too much. So any geneticist will reinforce this point, that while we largely, because for cultural reasons, think in terms of race, geneticists do not think in terms of race or largely ethnicity. But, of course, we do all have genetic differences, and there's no question that those differences do help us become different from one another. The question, and this is key, and I hope you hear the difference here, the semantic difference, the question is how these genes influence us. What do genes actually do? How do genetic differences actually translate into real-life differences? You might be surprised to learn that so far you've probably gotten most of your information on this subject from statistical studies, not from studies of how genes actually work. And that's not to put down these studies. They do have a place and a relevance. The point is, part of the point that I make in the book is they've been misused and misreported to mean more than they actually do mean. So you have undoubtedly read that there are, quote-unquote, genes for breast cancer and depression and baldness and for intelligence and personality, and there have been articles out there saying there are genes for infidelity and genes for criminality. Well, it turns out there's a big difference between what statistics tell us about genes. Again, it's useful in a very limited context. Big difference between that and what biology tells us about how genes work. What you read in the papers come from population studies of one sort or another. They look at a large number of people who have breast cancer or depression or baldness, and they look to find what genes they have in common, and they report that statistical correlation. A gene that 80% of bald people have in common turns up in the newspapers as the baldness gene. But the question is, what about that 20%? If you have the baldness gene, how could you not be bald? And here's a very funny illustration of that point. This is a man named Steven Pinker, who I'm sure you've heard of if you have any interest in science and genetics and ideas. He's one of the great and very prominent writers on the subject. And he, not so long ago, had his own genome decoded and wrote about that in the New York Times Magazine and pointed out that he has the baldness gene, 80% likely to be bald. How is it that Steven Pinker, that beautiful head of hair that I would pay a lot of money for, has the baldness gene, but not the actual baldness? And here's an even starker example of the same question. This is not about baldness anymore. And this is not some kind of super cat. Don't look for, like, the fifth leg or anything. This cat is an ordinary cat named Rainbow. And I'm showing you this picture because I want you to compare it to this picture of a cat named Cece, that is two C's. Now, this cat was actually, these two cats were in the news about 8 or 9 years ago. Is there anyone here who knows why this second cat is named Cece? And here's a picture of the same two cats side by side. That's right, carbon copy. Well, clone. So Cece on the right is a clone of Rainbow.
Really?
That is true. Verified, university proven, all that stuff. It's shocking, but true. Hopefully it won't be shocking in a few minutes when we talk about how this can happen. These two cats have exactly the same genes. How is this happening? Here's the answer. We've been taught to think of genes as blueprints of information that specify what our traits are supposed to look like. But that is actually not correct. That's not how genes work. And I'm obviously not the source of this knowledge. You heard the introduction. I'm not a scientist. I'm not bringing my own lab work to this. I am trying to bring to the public a lot of great work that's done by a lot of geneticists. And also, many of these geneticists are struggling to articulate this for the public, but it's very difficult kind of going against the wind of how we've talked about genes for 100 years. So let's look at a couple of statements from geneticists that start to explain how this could possibly be. This is from Michael Meaney, a very prominent geneticist, director of the Program for the Study of Genes, Behavior, and the Environment at McGill University in Canada. There are no genetic factors that can be studied independently of the environment, and there are no environmental factors that function independently of the genome. A trait emerges only from the interaction of gene and the environment. And we'll be talking in some detail about why this is and how that works. This is from Randy Jerdle, Director of Epigenetics and Imprinting at Duke University. Before we thought that genes predetermined outcomes, now we realize that everything we do, everything we eat or smoke can affect our gene expression and that of future generations. Epigenetics introduces the concept of free will into our idea of genetics. And the third quote for right now comes from Massimo Pigliucci, who is a scientist in New York who happens to live literally half a block from me. I got interested in his work about 2.5 years ago, and the book was published by the University of Tennessee, and he was at some other university at the time. So I just kind of sent an email out there trying to find this guy, and one thing led to another, and he's half a block from me, and we had coffee right down the street. His quote is, "Biologists have come to realize that if one changes either the genes or the environment, the resulting behavior can be dramatically different." Oh, that's a little soon. Let me just... Okay, so genes are not like robot actors who always say the same lines in exactly the same way. It turns out that genes, as you've seen from these quotes, interact with their surroundings and can say different things depending on whom they are talking to. So that's what's going on with those two cats. Same genes, different gene-environment interactions leads to different traits. They call this gene expression or gene-environment interaction. Those are kind of the two main ways of referring to this phenomenon, and it is pervasive. It is the way genes work. Now let's talk a little bit more specifically about how it works. This is obviously quite simplified, but this is the picture of a part of a cell. And what we have is the DNA, which is, as we all know, famously stable from parent to child. It's exactly this. You have the exact genes as you're from your father and your mother, and those don't change. And then the DNA gets met with a something called RNA messenger, which is kind of reading the DNA, and that happens in the nucleus, and then it's taking that messenger information outside the nucleus and assembling amino acids into a protein. And then it just keeps doing that over and over. Now, here's the key part about gene-environment interaction. It doesn't actually happen this simply, because there's always some outside forces which are affecting the relationship between DNA and the RNA messenger. So you can have the exact same DNA in two different people or two different cats or what have you, and the DNA is getting expressed in a different way depending from moment to moment on the various environmental variables that are impacting any given cell. Another quote here, although DNA starts off the causal chain, what really matters is the expression of the genes in terms of the messenger RNA. Oh, here is the quote, excuse me. There are no genetic effects without this expression. So you can see a lot of scientists are trying to find the way to get this out to the public, because this is relatively easy knowledge to understand, but they're still struggling to get heard, basically. So my contention, and the contention of all the scientists I've mentioned and plenty of others, is that this obliterates the longstanding metaphor of genes as blueprints with elaborate pre-designed instructions for eye color, thumb size, mathematical quickness, musical sensitivity, etc. Rather than finished blueprints, genes are more like volume knobs and switches. Think of a giant sound mixing board inside every cell in your body. So instead of a blueprint that's got the fixed information about what the genes how they're supposed to end up as traits, you've got all these switches and knobs, which are the genes, and they're constantly being adjusted by the environment around it. And the actual traits that emerge are the result of the unique interaction that are going on constantly. So that's what explains how the exact same gene in two different animals or even plants can produce different outcomes. And this happens constantly and all the time. So most of these knobs and switches can be turned up or down or on or off at any time by another gene or by any minuscule environmental input. This flipping and turning takes place constantly. It begins the moment a child is conceived and doesn't stop until she takes her last breath. Rather than giving us hardwired instructions on how a trait must be expressed, this process of gene-environment interaction drives a unique developmental path for every unique individual. So we're coming up with a new way of trying to understand and think and talk about how genes work. We're not running away from genetic influence. We're talking about how the influence actually works, and we're dismissing this idea of genes causing traits or even causing parts of traits, because it's all about that interaction. Genes powerfully influence the formation of all traits from eye color to intelligence, but rarely dictate precisely what those traits will be. So genes matter, and genetic differences will result in trait differences. But in the final analysis, each of us is a dynamic system, a creature of development. So let's look at this in yet another way. Under the old paradigm, we thought that genes came first and set the stage. You got genes creating proteins, creating cells, creating traits. And then, you know, we all know it's famous that nurture plays a part of this. But we thought it was kind of nature and then nurture, nature plus nurture. The environment kind of comes in and helps us define our traits or at least our abilities toward the end of the process. Here's the new paradigm. It's this feedback loop. It's this constant dynamic in which you can't actually ever fully separate out in a distinct way the influence of genes or the environment, because they're constantly interacting what that influence is. So there is no genetic foundation that gets laid before the environment enters in. Rather, genes express themselves strictly in accordance with their environment. Everything that we are from the first moment of conception is the result of this process. We do not inherit traits directly from our genes. Instead, we develop traits through the dynamic process of gene-environment interaction. And I apologize if some of this is sounding redundant. Sometimes I'm not sure whether I'm going too fast or too slow, because most of this will sound pretty new to you, and I want it to sink in. So here's the really great news, where we can now move into talking about abilities. We can have, and this is obvious from what I've already said, but we can have an impact on this interaction, which I should also quickly rush in to say as a caveat: it's not the same thing as saying we can fully control it. Having an impact doesn't mean we control all the variables. We're not even aware of anything like all the variables, and we never will be. So as we start to talk about how people get really good at stuff, let's take a look and a listen to one of the great achievers of our time. I'm just going to point this microphone down and play a few seconds. I don't know, but you had rather just keep listening to that than talk. But we've got work to do. So where does Yo-Yo Ma's ability come from? He's one of the people that I focus on in the book, and I'm going to read actually just a page or two about the circumstances that Yo-Yo Ma grew up in. And I don't know if I'll refer to Mozart, but yeah, I think I will in here. I talk about Mozart as well, and there's actually quite a number of eerie parallels. I won't detail them too much right now, but it's kind of extraordinary. So let's see, from page 76 of my book, if you're following along. This is interesting because one of the things I did is I looked at a memoir written by Yo-Yo Ma's mother, and it's fascinating. And so I'm going to start here. Marina Ma details how from the very moment of his birth, Yo-Yo was exposed to music in the most profound and exquisite way. Both Marina, a trained opera singer, and her husband, oh, I'm going to butcher this name, Kiao Tsun, a teacher, composer, conductor, had immigrated to Paris as young adults to study, play, compose, and teach music. Having traded comfort and status in China for immigrant poverty in France, the Ma family breathed, ate, and slept music. Their tiny two-room Paris apartment was arranged thusly. Mother and children, this is actually a quote from the book. Mother and children slept in one room. The other, a smaller bedroom studio, was used by Xiao Tsun, Yo-Yo's father. Amazingly, he had squeezed into that room his piano, a collection of children's string instruments, and his cot. His precious manuscripts and music scores meticulously arranged by him for children were jammed into an old armoire and piled up on the piano top. Every corner was bulging with his papers. Boy, I don't know why I used the name so many times if I was going to read this. Xiao Tsun studied at the conservatory by day and gave lessons in the evening, all the while clinging to his deeply personal dream of creating a children's orchestra. Like Leopold Mozart, he designed elaborate pedagogical techniques specifically for children and was eager to put them to use. Yo-Yo's older sister, I'm not even going to try to pronounce that name, was like Nannerl Mozart, who was Mozart's older sister, started on piano and violin at a very early age, around the time Yo-Yo was born. By the time Yo-Yo was ready to start piano at age 3, his sister was already a budding prodigy. And this is a quote. From the cradle, Yo-Yo was surrounded by a world of music, his mother recalls. He heard hundreds of classical selections on records or played by his father or his sister. Bach and Mozart were engraved on his mind. Engraved on his mind. According to neuroscientists and music psychologists, this is quite literally true. We know now that music activates neurons in many regions of the brain simultaneously, and that every meaningful listening experience inspires the formation of multiple trace memories, which in turn inform the encoding of all future musical memories. And this is a quote, melodic calculation centers in the dorsal temporal lobes appear to be paying attention to interval size and distances between pitches as we listen to music, creating a pitch-free template of the very melodic values we will need in order to recognize songs in transposition, explains McGill University's Daniel Levitin. Author of the book that did quite well, This Is Your Brain on Music. Levitin also concurs with University of California at San Diego's Diana Deutsch and others in deducing that every human being is likely born with a capacity for absolute pitch, but that it gets activated only in those who are exposed to enough tonal imprinting, at a very early age. In addition to the neural mechanics, there were also powerful psychological forces in Yo-Yo Ma's life that helped him help shape him into an obsessively determined musician at the youngest possible age. Yo-Yo worshipped his sister and father and desperately wanted to impress both. From very early on, he responded to his stern father, who had vowed to, quote, make a musician of him at age 2, with a blend of admiration, duty, and extreme stubbornness. Yo-Yo would hover in the doorway while his sister practiced, and when asked, critique her performances note by note. In his own performances, Yo-Yo was determined to have it his way. Sometimes he refused to perform for his parents as instructed. Other times he would play more than he was supposed to. He also needed to chart his own course instrumentally. I don't like the sound violins make, Yo-Yo informed his father at age 4. I want a big instrument. Once you start playing with a big instrument, you cannot switch back to the violin, his father responded firmly to his 4-year-old son. Don't tell me a month from now that you've changed your mind. I will play it, Yo-Yo insisted. I won't change my mind. And he did not. In retrospect, his early life contained all the known ingredients for the brewing of extraordinary achievement, an early and intensively conditioned musical brain, world-class teaching resources, not just his parents, but some teachers that his parents recruited, and a desperate personal desire that researchers universally agree is the key to precocious success. Psychologist Ellen Winter calls it the rage to master, a fervent, never let go willfulness and focus that drives a child into an early version of what psychologist Anders Ericsson calls deliberate practice, which is a specific kind of practice where you're actually always pushing yourself to fail, never satisfied with what you've achieved, but always pushing yourself just beyond your own limits and then trying to learn from those limits. And that's something I write about pretty extensively in the book. So now one question, which I'm sure is occurring to a lot of you, is where does this rage to master come from? You know, is that possibly innate, or, you know, where's that coming from? Well, what I found in looking at this subject broadly before I try to answer that specific question is that this idea that things are innate, that genes cause certain things, is so ingrained that we're kind of always the people who don't want to look for the nuanced answers. As soon as they kind of come up with a question, we'll quickly say, well, that part must be innate. And what I've tried to do is follow the lead of all these scientists saying, well, maybe it is, but let's look and see if we can find some influences that we just didn't see before and actually explain this stuff. It's very funny because, you know, several hundred years ago, if we were trying to explain this exact same thing, most of the people would say, well, God is doing that. This is coming from God, and that would be our explanation. And 100 years ago, after we discovered genes, the explanation would be, well, it's genes that are doing this. We're always looking for that explanation that satisfies our need to understand things. But what we're really doing in kind of inserting those very kind of simple-minded and short and easily digestible explanations is kind of running away from things that we just can't explain yet, and that we ought to just keep looking further to see if there are some nuances there. So this idea of tremendous persistence, can that be taught? That's obviously one big question that emerges, and that I address pretty extensively in the book. And you won't be surprised to hear me say that there's a lot of evidence that it can be taught, and I think I can back that up pretty explicitly, and I'm going to do a little bit of that right now. So the first part of trying to learn where persistence comes from is to look into the empowering reality of this kind of overall message, the idea that skills are actually acquired rather than innate, and the understanding that people who have that understanding feel empowered and will pursue without bounds these tremendous goals because they believe that it's process that takes them there rather than any kind of innate ability. I'm going to read another short section about a local hero of yours, Stanford psychologist Carol Dweck. She used to be at Columbia, but she's here now. And what she has brought to this discussion, which speaks to what I was just saying. One common characteristic in all successful adults is that at some point in their lives, they come to realize how much the process of improvement is within their own control. That's also what Stanford psychologist Carol Dweck observed in a series of grade school studies in the 1990s. In her central experiment, Dweck, who was then at Columbia, asked 400 seventh graders to complete a relatively easy set of puzzles and then randomly separated them into two groups. Individually, each student in the first group was complimented for his or her innate intelligence with the line, "You must be smart at this." Each student in the second group was praised for his or her effort. "You must have really worked hard." Then each child was offered a chance to take one of two follow-up tests, either another easy set of puzzles or a much harder set of puzzles that teachers promised would be a great learning experience. Here are the results. More than half the kids praised for their innate intelligence chose the easy follow-up puzzle. A staggering 90% of the kids praised for their hard work chose the more difficult puzzles. So people who understand that achieving success has to do with process and skill building are more ambitious and they do better. Simple as that. And there have been many, many studies to follow this up. This is not a fluke. Again, going to this question of whether persistence can be taught. Another comment which is relevant. This comes from Robert Cloninger, a Washington University biologist who told the San Francisco writer Poe Bronson, that many of you have heard of, that, yes, brain circuits that modulate a person's level of persistence are plastic. This idea that they can be changed. They can be altered. And the quote, his quote is, the key is intermittent reinforcement. A person who grows up getting too frequent rewards will not have that persistence because they'll quit when the rewards disappear. This also fits with other studies of great achievement, which I get into in the book. One of them is the ascetic philosophy of Kenyan runners, which is a part of their culture which affects hugely their intense level of motivation to run from a very, very early age and to run very, very hard. And yet another data point here comes from Stanford psychologist Walter Mischel, who is the lead investigator in the famous marshmallow study, where they learned about the importance of delayed gratification. And what isn't as widely reported is that in his side experiments, they were able to transform kids' wait times by suggesting how to think of the rewards. When kids were staring at real marshmallows, were encouraged to imagine them as pictures of marshmallows, making them more abstract in their minds, it lengthened their ability to wait from 6 to 18 minutes. And the reverse was also true. Kids imagining pictures as real marshmallows had their waiting ability shortened. So, fairly simple experiment, but opening up a real insight into this suggestion that, yes, these things can be taught. And I noticed someone just left, and she missed just a minute because this is the end of my talk. There's much more to say about the science and process of great achievement. I think that's probably obvious. But I think that we've touched enough on genetics to hopefully open up your minds to see that this is more than just saying, well, it's nature or it's nurture. And I'd like to close with two quotes, actually. One is just an amazing quote that I found near the end of writing my book from the amazing musician and artist Brian Eno, who I think probably doesn't know a lot about this science, but said what I'm trying to say in my book in just such a profound way, and just really gels so nicely with the whole message of the book and with everything that I saw, all the science that I've seen over the last few years. It is slightly profane, I warn you. We can edit this out for broadcast, I suppose. Here's Brian Eno's quote. What would really be interesting for people to see is how beautiful things grow out of shit. Nobody ever believes that it happens that way. Everybody thinks that Beethoven had his string quartets completely in his head, that it somehow appeared there and formed in his head, and that all he had to do was write them down. What would really be a lesson that everybody should learn is that things come out of nothing. Things evolve out of nothing. The tiniest seed in the right situation turns into the most beautiful forest. And then the most promising seed in the wrong situation turns into nothing. I think this would be important for people to understand because it gives people confidence in their own lives to know that that's how things work. If you walk around with the idea that there are some people who are so gifted that they have these wonderful things in their head, but you're not one of them, you're just sort of a normal person. But with this new insight, you could have another kind of life. You could say, well, I know that things come from nothing very much and start from unpromising beginnings, and I'm an unpromising beginning. I could start something. I just love that. It really really resonates with what I'm trying to say. And finally, I just want to read, and this is just really cruel of me for anyone who plans to read the book, but I guess it's a little masochistic. I'm going to read the epilogue, the last page of my book, and I'm going to blow the whole mystery for you, which is a joke. Obviously, this is not a narrative book that has a great mystery in it. But I do talk. For those of you who read the book, you'll see that I talk about Ted Williams. I start the book with Ted Williams. I talk about him throughout the book. There's just a lot of really neat lessons to be learned and gleaned from his. From his life, and so I decided to end the book with talking about that and something else. Parts of the North Park neighborhood of San Diego don't seem to have changed a whole lot since Ted Williams' time. His tiny boyhood home at 4121 Utah Street still stands. Two short blocks away, his old practice baseball field is still there too. They call it Ted Williams Field now. Outside the batting cage are sign-up sheets for Little League. On the sunny afternoon I was there, the field sat empty, No one feverishly hitting baseballs until the threads and skins wore off, which is what Ted did. No one shagging balls for lunch money, which is what Ted paid people to do so that even as a very poor kid, he could just keep hitting balls. Maybe instead some 11-year-old kid was inside somewhere practicing the cello with all his heart or building a new piece of software that will change the world. With the field completely empty, it was easier to imagine Ted standing at home plate, yelling at his friend to throw another one, and harder this time, to see a few kids standing in the outfield, gloveless, trying to catch the balls but missing most of them. The bat cracks every few seconds, and Ted occasionally mutters, "That's it, that's it." Every time he misses the ball or cracks a foul, he takes note of his stance and his swing. He marks how the ball left the pitcher's hand and how it spun and how it traveled. When he started his swing and exactly how he moved his shoulders and his hips and his wrists. I think of my two kids, and I wonder if they'll have the same level of determination with any craft. I wonder if I want them to. The truth is, I do want my kids to dream big and to never give up. I can't pick their dreams for them and wouldn't dare try. But I can tell them, as my mother and father told me, that any dream is worth having, and there's no telling what you can do when you put your mind to it. The only difference between that generation and this one is that my parents were speaking from intuition, faith, and experience. I'm speaking from intuition, faith, experience, and science. Thank you so much for coming. Appreciate it.
Thank you, David. We'd like to remind our listening and viewing audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to and viewing The Genius in All of Us with David Shank. So I'm going to open up the floor to questions, and I'm going to pass around the microphone. If you have any questions, please raise your hand and wait until you have the microphones because we are recording. Okay, here.
So it's clear that environment can improve performance. And what's the evidence, what's the scientific evidence that environment can change genes? In other words, you had the train between genes, proteins, traits, et cetera.
Right.
But what is the evidence, the scientific evidence, that any environmental factors can change genes?
Okay, well, there are two answers to that. The first is that most importantly, the environment doesn't change genes. It impacts how genes are expressed. So now there are random mutations, which then speaks to Darwinism, and I'm not talking about that now, and I'm not an expert in evolution. I think there actually are some implications of some of this for understanding, having a new understanding of evolution, but I haven't really dealt with that. I mean, there's a lot of new data which is helping us understand evolution in new ways, but that's really an aside. So the first answer is genes. I hope I wasn't misunderstood. If I contribute to that, I apologize, to say that the environment changes genes. It actually only changes how genes are expressed and therefore the consequences that are going to come out of gene expression. The second answer is a little more complicated, and I didn't really get into this because it's another level, and I didn't. There's just so many levels to this, but the very last chapter of my book is about epigenetics, and that's a new science that some of you may have read about. And epigenetics is about is another way of looking at how genes are expressed, and at this kind of crazy idea, which has now been proven to be absolutely true, at least in some cases, and seems to be more and more widespread the more scientists look at it. Although we don't, the genes that parents pass to their children are exactly the same. They stay intact. There's a wrapping that goes around those genes that also passes from parent to children and that greatly influences gene expression. And that actually does change and can be altered by the environment, which is to say, crazy as it sounds, that things that we do in our life which can impact the epigenome before we have kids then will get passed on to our kids and will subsequently affect their own gene expression. So decisions that we make, decisions that I make, or I should say that I made before I had kids, affected not the genes but the epigenome around the genes that I passed on, and will have an effect and are having an effect on my own kids' lives, which I wouldn't expect anyone to just accept at face value. It sounds crazy. It is crazy. It brings up the whole notion of Lamarck, who long before Darwin suggested that behaviors and experience actually change our genes. And actually that turns out to be really close to true in some ways. So that's kind of the second and more complex answer. And if you're interested, I invite you to read the chapter on epigenetics, or there's plenty of articles about it too, but I was happy that I was able to include that before I finished the book.
Thank you. Next question.
I'm already assuming that what you're saying is true, but I've looked at epigenetics. You probably know David Schervan-Schreiber. So you've seen his diagrams where he shows how...
I don't know his work really well, but...
But he's got diagrams showing that it changes based on diet, based on a number of things.
Yeah.
So if we accepted your premise, which I'm fine with, and I think a lot of people here are,
okay,
what would you like to see happen in terms of education in the world? Where would you like to take this instead of just fighting the battle of nature versus nurture?
Yeah.
How would you like to take that forward?
I'm going to give you probably give a couple answers to each question. The first one is just honestly, I have not given this much deep thought. It took me a couple years and several hundred pages, I said, to try to figure out just how to understand this stuff and bring it to a general audience. And I don't want to say I ran out of time. That was my whole purview, was trying to understand these different arenas of science and to try to talk about them in a new way. And I do get into implications for parenting and education a little bit in the book. There are some themes, but my real hope is to take this to educators and policy analysts and parents and nudge, you know, the conversation in such a way that they can bring their experience, their expertise to bear and say, okay, now here's what we do with this. That's the first answer. The second answer is, I'll just reiterate what I said about Carol Dweck and say that I think that there are a couple, you know, big principles here, and one that I think that we can build into our educational system in all sorts of ways is this notion, and that we can just point blank tell teachers, make sure they understand and make sure they express to their kids, their students, is the importance of this idea, the importance of emphasizing to kids this distinction between the wrong idea that intelligence comes from this innate thing and that you've got a certain amount of it, and that if you're good at something, it's because you're born with that, and if you're bad at something, it's because that's just that's your lot in life, and that instead understanding intelligence as this accumulation of skills, which I think is not only the more progressive way to think about it, it also turns out to yield much better results. It also gels with all the science that we're talking about here. And I think that actually, that just that notion can we can do a lot with that. You know, there's a lot we can play with that, but how to introduce that, how often to introduce it, how to build it into curricula and so forth. So I hope that doesn't sound like a cop-out. That's about as far as I've gone. Yes?
It's returning to the first gentleman's question. So in the case of the cats,
yeah,
I assume they were both in utero getting all the same influences epigenetically, and so they came out looking different over the course of their lives once they were born, or did they emerge from the womb? Because you're saying that, you know, there's...
Well, one was a clone of the other, so one was an adult. And then the second,
oh, right,
the second. So they're not identical twins, they're a clone. So there was an adult, and then they took cells and they created a clone. So yes, the point here is that from the, you know, when we see identical twins, almost all the time, first, identical twins are thought to have exactly the same genes. It's not quite correct, but they have virtually the same genes, and we see identical twins all the time, and it gives us this picture of the power of genes. Wow, they've got the same genes, they look alike. What we're really seeing in how identical twins look alike, at least for a while, particularly early on, is that they have identical gene-environment interactions because they're raised in the same womb. And so what we're seeing with clones now, and this is not the only instance, I hope that's obvious, is that when you actually have the exact same set of genes raised gestating in a completely different environment, and I actually don't know if it was, if they then put it into, I don't think they put it into Rainbow's womb. I don't know what the surrogate was in this case. But clearly different environments because they weren't even being raised at the same time. They were being raised a generation apart. So the different, that's the different gene-environment interaction, which the same exact genes then led to these very different traits.
In your research, did you stumble across nanotechnology?
Nanotechnology. It doesn't come into my book, but tell me what you mean. Maybe I'm missing the relevance.
Maybe some gene splicing or something.
Gene splicing.
With miniature robots.
There's a lot of crazy, I don't mean crazy. There's a lot of, you know, really extraordinary tools out there to work with genes. And I don't know much about the details of most of them. And I imagine that nanotechnology plays a role, but I really can't speak to that. That's for a geneticist to answer.
Any other questions?
I had a question about environment. When you had mentioned environment as playing an integral role of how genes, I guess, end up or
yes.
are expressed.
Right.
How much of that environment would be considered like, you know, living next to a toxic zone or, you know, environment, bad environment, not being able to move around a lot, bad weather, that type of thing.
Right.
And how much of that would be cultural, like in the society or even the dynamics within a family?
Right. Great question.
Environment is, I mean, it's kind of all-inclusive, and I was wondering how much.
Right. Right. The term connotes something quite broad. I think you basically just answered your question. I can't really give you a statistic that says, it's, you know, environment is mostly this or mostly that, but I'll make your point again, which is that environment is everything we see, everything we know about, and a lot of stuff we don't know about. It's the oxygen, it's the air we breathe, it's the nutrition we eat, it's the stresses we have, it's the thoughts we have, it's the values that come to us from our culture through the media and through our social networks. It is the hormones in our body, which are the levels of which are affected constantly by the lives we lead. So there isn't anything that's out of bounds here. Anything that you could imagine that's could be considered environment could and will impact this gene environment interaction. Sure.
Taking that one step further, what if you have two men and they both lose their wife and they both lose their job in a short amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
One man goes out and gets a new wife and a new job, and the other man jumps off the Golden Gate Bridge.
Yeah.
So environment and therefore is the same for both, or the amount of stress they're under, yet they handle it completely differently. Would that be from their genetic code, or would that be?
Well, I think you're leaving out a lot of stuff there. You know, I think I don't know these two men, but I'm. Well, no, I'll just say that just to speak to what I said before, development brings us along a certain path, and these two guys are very different guys, so they experience stress differently. I doubt they have exactly the same way of seeing the world. I doubt they have exactly the same support network. So even though they're going to experience a stress that in some ways mirrors the stress and traumatic event that mirrors the traumatic event of the other person, they're going to deal with it differently for a wide range of reasons, a lot of which have to do with the lives that they led up to this moment. And I'm also going to run in and say, yes, genes are involved in that, but I think you won't be surprised to hear me say that the genes, there aren't going to be any distinct genetic effects. Their difference in genes are going to have an influence in that, for sure, but we're not going to be able to tease that out in any way. And it's really this developmental path that involved the genes that got them to where they are and have one guy react differently. a lot of variables.
Do you have a perspective on how much of human intelligence is not genetic, i.e. it can be changed by diet, training, problem solving, etc.? Have you seen any research that quantifies that in any way, since intelligence is measurable and there are metrics for it?
I don't really agree with your characterization that intelligence is measurable. There are metrics for types of intelligence. The most important thing to say about the study of intelligence is that we've been studying it for pretty seriously for 100, 150 years, and any intelligence researcher will tell you what we know is this much and what we don't know is this much. So there are some metrics, but they're all imperfect in very profound ways. To answer your question, I think more directly, it's clear that there are serious genetic influences on our intelligence. But go back to the two cats and let's talk about cat intelligence. They are going to have the exact same genes, and yet they're going to have different types of cat and different levels of cat intelligence, if we could jump in there, because of those gene-environment interactions. So the message is not that genes don't affect us. The message is that we can actually impact our genes and that gene-environment interaction. Not to say that we can control it, not to say that we'll be able to completely master it, but the more we learn about what we can do from the environmental and experiential side, the more we can do to build up our own intelligence, even though we are going to have differences that do have genetic slivers to them.
Are you aware of David Duncan's book, The Experimental Man, where he validates exactly what you just said? He's had genetic blueprints done of his body, and from three different points of view, his heart could be in really bad shape, it could be in normal shape, or it could be in excellent shape, but epigenetics rules, which is based on his behavior, based on what he's doing, things have changed radically. So even though one expression says he could be immediate risk for a heart attack, he's nullified that by something like 82 or 88%.
Wow. I'm not aware of it, but I appreciate the recommendation. Sounds fascinating.
We have time for only one last question. So who has the burning question?
Who wants it most?
So would you like to pick the...
Oh, I'm not going to do that. Okay, no way.
So who would like to ask? Maybe two then, here and there, and then that's it.
I came a little bit late, so if I'm asking a question that Yuri talked about, I apologize. But what got you interested in the subject?
What got me interested? A lot of things. First of all, the great thing about this topic... There's a wonderful thing and a horrible thing. The horrible thing is that everyone's got an opinion and that most people are convinced that their opinion is correct. And I could make my argument for 2 hours and someone will just, if they think differently, they're just going to say, sorry, you're wrong. The great thing is that everyone is interested in this. And anyone who's ever tried to be good at something, anyone who's grown up in this world is interested in what makes us who we are, what makes us good at stuff, what makes us not so good at stuff. Parents are doubly interested in it, for obvious reasons. So I've always been interested in these things, just as anyone else has. I've had my own experience with being good at stuff and being not so good. Played the violin actually rather well for a while and then lost interest in it. And it's always been my personal experience that that I got exactly out of the violin what I put into it. I was very intense about it for a couple of years, and I was very good for my age. And then as I lost interest in it, I quickly became not so good. And the same with other pursuits. And so that's kind of the deep background. More explicitly, I had a series of conversations with people as I was writing my last book, which was actually about the history of chess. And I also stumbled across some research about how people become really good at chess that talked about talent and where it comes from. And I kind of tripped into this whole world of expertise studies, which is about how you get good at stuff, which is a kind of brand new arena of science. It's really fascinating. It's several chapters about it in my book. And I read some hints that suggested some of the themes that I'm now talking about in the book. It just seemed They didn't shock me. They did surprise me a little bit. But what really surprised me is how this stuff wasn't really being talked about in this way at all. And as a writer who tends to dive deeply into subjects and then help bring messages out to the general public, I just thought, wow, this is an amazing opportunity. No one has done it yet, so I'm going to try. I'm the idiot who gets to try to do it. And I'm just very, very fortunate in my work to be supported by a publisher who pays me enough to spend several years, you know, trying to learn about this stuff and form relationships with scientists and then write stuff and show it to those scientists and have them, you know, tell me how I'm missing the boat in all these ways and then correct that and just over time form a thesis which both is kind of vetted by the scientists and they put their stamp on it and also makes sense to the general public.
Just a comment. As an ex-student of Dr. Baruch Skinner, who you're very familiar with,
yep.
I can just picture him in the psychological Neverland dancing up and down like one of his pigeons because it sounds to me like what you're saying is behaviorism is making a comeback.
Well, you know, this message is not about saying that we're all a blank slate. This message is not about kind of doing the environmental version of taking the clones and saying, well, if you give them exactly the same environment, any two people exactly the same environment, that they're going to turn out the same. It's a very, very different message from that. It can sound a lot like what people used to talk about as the blank slate idea, but that's only if you're looking at this stuff in black and white terms. And I think what we're all headed towards, hopefully, except for people at the extremes who don't really have an interest in having a conversation about this, is appreciating and continuing to investigate the influence of genes, but understanding the nature of that influence and also being wide open to all the wonderful ways that we can impact that interaction. So I think it's a third way. I'm very humbled that a lot of scientists who I kind of took my ideas from are really agreeing with me that there is this new third way and that this is an advance forward. And I hope that it's a part of a conversation that's a lot more interesting than that one. Thank you very much. Thanks again.
Our thanks to David for his comments here today. We also thank our audience here, as well as listening and viewing audience. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 107th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.